We have a colleague of mine who actually worked with way back in tobacco reduction, and she's the one who pulled me into safety. And she used to say, if it doesn't feel ugly, messy, dirty, it means you're not on the right track. And we still use that today. If it feels too simple, if it feels too linear and too easy, you're missing something.
Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across northern British Columbia. Casting today from the traditional territories of the Kleklaytané and Tsingtian First Nations are your hosts.
I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
You're listening to QualityCast North. Our subject today is healthcare safety, and we're continuing with our Leadership in Healthcare Quality series. We're taking in the view from 10,000 feet today and hearing about the role of provincial healthcare quality organizations. Health Quality BC is a leader in this group, and many of our listeners will already be aware of the highly regarded annual quality forum it organizes, with delegates attending from across the country and often internationally. But Health Quality BC is much more than Quality Forum, and here to talk about healthcare safety is today's guest, the CEO of Health Quality BC, Christina Krause. Welcome, Christina. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we always start our interviews off learning a little bit about our guests. So I'm hoping that you can tell us a little bit about your background and perhaps a little bit about your career journey to CEO of Health Quality BC.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey for me. And I think anytime you ask somebody why they do what they do, there's usually a story there. I am the daughter of a community pediatrician and a nurse who then turned into a dance teacher. So I grew up seeing healthcare from that side of the world. My dad was a pediatrician in Penticton in the interior of BC on Silk's territory. And because my mom taught ballet, I spent a lot of time waiting for him to do rounds and after school or after my own dance practices and things like that. But when I was about 16 years old, both my parents had significant serious illness. My mom was diagnosed with advanced breast cancer, and my dad had gone on the lung transplant list 2 weeks prior to her diagnosis. So I found myself pretty young age, grade 11, needing to navigate and help support both my parents' healthcare journeys. And my dad at the time loved medicine, everything about it. He was passionate about. And so he was really keen on not being a patient, even though he now was one. For him to give up his practice was very difficult. He ended up actually working at the Children's and helped create the BC Pediatric Society, which is around today. He, you know, sort of fell into administrative work during the time that he had from his first transplant. And his physician at the time wasn't comfortable with him being a clinician anymore. And so I spent a lot of the time watching this battle between my dad and his care providers around, you know, sort of who was in control of the care, and him being told, you're no longer a physician, you're now a patient, so you don't need to know your test results. Now, the good news is this was in the early 90s, and this wouldn't happen today. We're in a very different place almost 30 years later. But here we were, having lots of challenges. He experienced 3 preventable adverse events, significant patient safety events, 2 of which he actually flagged for his clinical team that there were challenges, and both times he was not listened to. I think because of that ongoing battle and control, but he ended up picking up aspergillus in the ICU following a second transplant. And so he passed away at the age 53. And that was just as I was figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. I was just finishing up a degree in nutrition and family science at UBC. And I had thought I was either going to go into dietetics or I was going to go and teach nutrition in schools. And I came across a course in my third year university on health promotion, which was this whole concept of prevention of illness. So for me, that resonated very strongly. And so I did a master's degree in epidemiology and community health at the University of Saskatchewan, and then found myself living, when I finished that, in Alberta, and helped set up some of the first primary care networks way back when, and working in tobacco reduction. And then it was a colleague of mine who I'd worked with in tobacco reduction who said to me, come, it was about 2005, she said, come join me on this patient safety work. And all I could think was it was the patient safety, which had consumed my time in Calgary of working on the first off-property smoking policy in Canada, that patient safety must be about patients falling when they were on the sidewalks to, having to go far away from the doors to smoke a cigarette. But it wasn't, it was so much bigger. And as she started to talk to me about it, I realized that work was what my parents went through. And so I found actually this place that, driven as a family member, driven by somebody who was passionate about healthcare and wanting to, make people have better care experiences, either from prevention, but then all of a sudden, you're learning more about patient safety. And I've always been interested in people. So the psychology of change and culture and relationships and shared decision making, all of those things. And here it was before me, this opportunity to do all of that, safety, effective care, respectful care. That then became my job. So it's actually been 20 years, I realized the other day, that I've been working in this field. And I sometimes get a bit animated and opinionated, which people who know me often give me a hard time about. But I think it stems from those early experiences of being a family member and having to advocate. And knowing the consequences of when care doesn't go well, I still struggle. If you ask me to meet you in the VGH cafeteria, I'm going to have a really hard time. That's over 30 years. That second floor is still tough for me to go to. So, it doesn't leave you. And so I feel honored to do this job and to be able to try and improve. And when I look back at the care experiences then and where we are today, we have changed things. We have moved the needle quite significantly, even though, and especially now, it feels like we probably haven't, but we actually have.
That's an amazing story. We actually hear it time again on this podcast how people's early childhood experiences drive their direction in future career, in what they choose to pursue based on those early experiences. And that's really, really interesting to hear. And you know what? The strongest advocates are the ones who have those experiences in this world, right? And so you're perfectly positioned, I think, to fulfill the role you're in. So that's perfect. It's worked out really well. And 20 years is a long career journey, but yeah. But you're right. Some of those things never leave us, right? Some of those early
No.
experiences, and they
No.
just drive us even harder. So, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, just thinking about how that stays with you and shows up, I would argue in a good way in the passion and your response sometimes and what gives you that probably that joy and work peace.
It gets me into trouble too, though, Lee, when you're new to career and you're learning, how to navigate politics and things like that. I was fortunate to have Doug Cochran as my sort of first boss in this field of safety, and he's heard me tell it many times, but he would start to recognize before I would when I was starting to get quite emotional, and he used to kick me under the table in a meeting to sort of get me to, it wasn't the right time for my passion. So passion is good, but it's great when you have colleagues on your team who help you understand how to use it well, right? Because if you don't, you can actually isolate people. So it's I now know my signs when I'm starting to sort of get to that point. I start to lean on the table, which was when he started to kick, and I started to recognize that. So now if I lean, I take a step back and I can take a pause in a positive way. So passion good, but yeah, in the right direction, I suppose, as well.
So what is HQBC? What is its role? And where does it sit in the provincial health care quality landscape? Could you help situate it for us?
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. And some people may know us as the BC Patient Safety Quality Council, which when we were created in 2008, we were actually announced at the same time as the Patient Care Quality Review Boards. So there was a throne speech that the health minister at the time was George Abbott, and they announced both of those and both organizations in February 2008. And Doug, who I mentioned earlier, who's a pediatric neurologist and also a leading expert in safety in Canada, was the founding chair. And he and I had been working together with the BC Patient Safety Task Force, and he asked me to join him to start this new organization. So our mandate is quite broad, actually, which in many ways, it speaks to the foundations of what you need to advance quality within a system, but it enables us to focus and to respond to the needs of the system. So one of our roles is around provincial coordination around efforts to improve quality of care. And we do that through a number of ways. It really is about bringing people together across various diverse groups to look at different issues around quality. So we've done that in different ways in the past. Sometimes it's advancing work that various partners are wanting to do. I think one of the big examples right now is the administrative burdens work that the Doctors of BC and the Ministry of Health both supported. And they came to us to say, can you be the sort of the workhorse of that work in support of our partnership? So we're doing that. But other times it's bringing groups together around, challenging issues that we have in the system. We did some work around principles for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples around complaints. And, there have been a lot of churning around trying to respond to the In Plain Sight report and not much movement. And so we said, we're going to bring everybody together and actually have a conversation and build out what some principles may be. So the system-wide coordination and leadership role, we do the quality forum, we do lots of different pieces. The second piece of our mandate is to build capability and capacity for people to lead improvement work. So that is a lot of the learning programs. We have our Quality Academy, which is a 6-month professional development program, which is why I'm actually in Vancouver today. I was just teaching today. We have online quality cafes on various topics, workshops. And anytime we're doing work with partners, we're always trying to look at how do we build the capability so people can lead themselves. And I think that's part of my community health background and sort of a community development approach. Is an approach that we take in everything that we do. We also have a mandate to advance improvements in the quality of care. So we run provincial clinical collaboratives on various topics. We've just launched a new one, deconditioning for the frail population, which we're really looking to look at how do we prevent deconditioning, but how do we also address goals of care? How do we build in a what matters to you conversation? How do we reduce safety events in that population? We've done work around the opioid use disorder, alcohol use disorder, but then also things like sepsis, inappropriate use of antipsychotics in long-term care, medication reconciliation back in the day, stroke care, lots of various topics. And we look at what the needs are in the system and where it might benefit from a coordinated approach to improvement. And then we also have a role in advancing the patient voice and the public voice in health system improvement. So we do run the Patient Voices Network, for example, and we are testing out a new model, sort of exploring how we can rebuild trust between the public and the healthcare system through an approach of raising the voice of community members, so place-based community members, into the conversation on quality. And then lastly, because we actually are a government organization, so we are accountable directly to the Minister of Health. So we're not part of a health authority, we're not part of the ministry, we're not part of any professional association. We are standalone, but we are accountable to and receive our funding through the provincial government. And our board chair, our current chair is Dr. Devin Harris, who is from Kelowna, an emergency room physician, a transport physician, and also works for Interior Health. And then the minister appoints Devin as well as a number of council members who provide a strategic advisory role to the organization and to the staff around the work that we do. And so we do have a role around being able to provide advice to the Minister of Health. And that can either be at request or it can be if we think something's really important, we can advance advice to the minister around issues around quality of care. So it's diverse, it's big, and so we're always thinking about how do we achieve our mandate and really make sure we're adding value to the system within the realities that the system is currently facing. And we do operational planning every year and work with partners to figure out what would be most helpful. So that's a probably a lot more long-winded than you'd hope for, but I hope gives that the fulsome background of who we are and why we do what we do.
So HQBC has just launched its new BC patient safety strategy. Can you tell us about this and maybe how has strategy for improving healthcare safety evolved over the last 5 years? So just kind of like first all around this new strategy.
It's such a thank you for bringing it forward because I think if you were to ask me, what am I really excited about right now, I would say the patient safety strategy is right up there. As I mentioned, when I started in patient safety was in 2005 with the launch of Safer Healthcare Now, which was a national patient safety strategy that resulted from the Baker-Norton report. And the most recent data from CAHI shows that even though we've been working hard over the last 20 years, we still have harm occurring in at least one in every 17 hospital stays. And that's from CAHI 2024 data. We also have expanded our view of what safety is. For the longest time, it was the absence of physical harm. But we also have recognized the importance of cultural safety and also the importance of psychological safety. So when we talk about patient safety, we're talking about all three of those aspects. So there's an expanded definition that we have. And there's also recognition, as exactly as you say, that it isn't just about an event happens, we learn, and then we try to come up with recommendations to prevent it from ever happening again. Now we know we need to do that. We know that's important. However, there's been a lot of new thinking and understanding and evidence that recognizes there's just as much learning around preventing harm from understanding when things go well. Some people talk about this as the concept of safety one and safety two. Safety one being the traditional sort of approach to understanding safety, the sort of root cause analysis, and safety two being the more proactive learning from when things go well. And I think about some of the systems that we have designed in response to really big, high profile, tragic events, but that are incredibly rare. And we build out a number of solutions to try and prevent a situation like that from happening again. Now we have to learn from those events and we have to look at them, but healthcare is so complex that sometimes when we've put those changes in, it's actually caused other challenges in the system. And so there's I think an opportunity to understand when things work really well. Which for most of the time, when you look at 5.6 out of 100 hospitalizations, things are working. So what is that? You know, there's a lot of reflections right now around mental health, and we had the Lapu-Lapu Festival, which was just shocking and deeply troubling event that happened. And so you can look at that event and say, what happened? How did we prevent that from happening again? And this was an individual who was out on pass in community. But if you look at that in isolation, I think it sometimes gives us some risks. There are a large number of people who are on pass out in community who do very well. And so we don't generally study those to understand. So what is it that contributes to doing well? And how did we fail that individual by not giving them the same things? And so that's part of the understanding that we're trying to bring in to advance and understand safety. And I think one of the big examples I'm observing right now is sort of a post-pandemic consequence around the role of the patient and family. So in my own personal experiences, you know, with my dad, but even in my own care, you know, for years we used to tell patients, and we had providers where, I don't know if you ever wore the ask me if I washed my hands button. Which put it all on this on the patient to feel psychologically safe to ask you if you've washed your hands. And you know, my own GP back when I was in Penticton was Dr. Jeff Harries, who I think many people in this province know Jeff, who is just such an amazing individual. And, we used to get in trouble from his MOA when I'd have my appointments because we'd take way too long. We'd start talking about work and I'd mess up his entire day to the point that she'd only book me as the last appointment of the day when I would need to see him so that I didn't totally screw up his schedule. But I remember him coming in one time and I remember thinking, I don't think he's washed his hands. And I couldn't ask him if he had. And I thought, here is such an interesting scenario where there's two people who are passionate about safety and quality working it in partnership together, and I still couldn't do it. So if you look at some of the really big, especially in the pediatric cases, there's often a parent who was raising a flag who wasn't listened to. And, when we had the pandemic, we removed the patient, the family members off the care team, and we didn't backfill them. So we saw a lot of consequences in long-term care homes. We saw during pandemic unexplained weight loss rates go up in long-term care, increase in depressive symptoms, and an increase in use of antipsychotics. To me, those are what I'm sort of calling like family presence indicators. And so when you think about safety going forward, we onboarded a lot of new young staff. We had this amazing presenter at our quality forum this year, a young nurse who started working in a hospital on the island during COVID. She wasn't trained as she started working with family members present and understanding the important role of family members as being part of the care team. And so I think if you look in the safety strategy at pillar one, looking at the opportunity to raise the voice and actually have patient or family members become part of the care team again, but also listen to when they are raising concerns. That's what will drive safety, not necessarily going and doing the wait for the event, doing the root cause analysis, and then trying to implement those recommendations. They are important and they are part of our responsibility, I think, to patient and family members when harm occurs. That we give them an accurate understanding in the care, that we share what we are doing to do better into the future, and that we're giving them the apology. Those are the three things that family members want. And I think that's what excites me about what we've learned on safety from 20 years ago to today, is it is the monitoring and the proactive look, but it's so much more. And I think if we can do this, a lot of this is culture and people, right? And it's relationships and it's making sure that we create the right environment for healthcare workers to be able to give safe care, to be able to have the time to stop and listen to the family member. A colleague of mine who actually worked with way back in tobacco reduction, and she's the one who pulled me into safety. And she used to say, if it doesn't feel ugly, messy, dirty, it means you're not on the right track. And we still use that today. If it feels too simple, if it feels too linear and too easy, you're missing something.
Those are great insights, and I think thank you for that. And that's why it's pillar number one, right? So
Yeah,
it's right
exactly.
at the up front. And thank you
Yeah.
for explaining that. I want to go back though, just to something you mentioned a little bit earlier about telling your doctor, "Have you washed your hands?" That psychological safety piece, right? Because
Yes. Yeah.
psychological safety, you're right. It's key. It's absolutely vital when it comes to maintaining safety, identifying events before they happen.
I think right now, in our system today, there is a lack of psychological safety across the board. So, whether you are a clinician, whether you are an administrator, whether you are point of care staff or a new grad or somebody who's been working for 30, 40 years, or in a leadership role, I think the tension in the system, the challenges that we're having, and the societal world we're living in with increasing divisions, but also things like social media and the immediateness have changed the context in which we're working. I have the opportunity to talk to all sorts of different kinds of people in the system, from senior leaders to point of care staff to middle managers to clinicians of all sorts to patients to family members. And everybody tells me the same thing. They don't feel safe in their role and with each other. So I think it's very easy, especially when you are under stress. And I think a lot of people are under stress right now. Clinicians working short, the challenges we're having with our primary care system. I mean, it feels endless, and on the clinical side. But on the administrative side, they're also experiencing stresses that are different. But we tend to, and this is very classic in a complex system like healthcare, is to do something what we call sense making. And when you sense make, it is your pattern of determining what is happening for somebody else. And we do this based on our own values. We do this based on our own experiences. We do this based on the culture within an organization. And right now, I think one of our biggest challenges is the time that is needed to be curious about each other's experiences and lived experiences to understand why people are behaving the way they're behaving, whether you are a physician or a frontline nurse, or you're a director or a CEO of a health authority. In our Quality Academy, one of the things we often talk about, people will say, well, the Ministry of Health never understands. And they always are asking us for stuff and they don't understand. And often my response is, well, have you asked them what their challenges are and what they need and what their life is like? Well, no. Okay. Well, maybe we should take some time to do that before we jump to conclusion. And I'm seeing sense making happening with negative consequences. So more judging going on. And that then in a psychologically unsafe environment, because the public is very unhappy, and rightly so. There's significant challenges in care, but it's quite adversarial. And when you have that stress, it's like a perfect storm. The response often is to try and control more and to judge. And I think that's the biggest thing that worries me, right? One of the big things that worries me right now is, do we have the space and the trust right now to actually sit down and have a conversation? I would love to have community members be part of this conversation and say, these are the constraints we have. We have to figure out together, what are we going to be able to do? Because we can't do it all. I ask a lot of people, do you feel psychologically safe? And I have not had anyone in the last 2 years tell me, yeah, I do. So I think it starts small. One of the best things I've done over my career is actually gone and shadowed people. I spent time a couple of weekends with an advanced care paramedic to really understand what life is like. I had the opportunity to shadow an emergency physician a couple years ago, and that is, the time to. And I remember when I went and did that, the charge nurse said to me, sort of halfway through, you're still here. I mean, you're not just one of those leaders doing a leadership walk around and you're here for 10 minutes, because they always come when it's great, when things are working well, and they miss the, but you're here the whole time. I said, yeah, no, I'm here. I think I was there for 8 hours or something. And at the end of the shift, he said, nobody thought you'd stay the whole time and that you would give up that much time, and you were just here to listen and learn. And they said, even if nothing changes out of your being here today, because they said, we know you don't work for the health authority, you've changed for me that you took the time to come and listen. And so I think if you can, spending time with each other to be curious and to learn, whether that's shadowing somebody for 4 hours to understand each other's experiences or to take that time, helps. And to be honest, when you don't know and that you're going to get things wrong, and to accept that we're all going to get things wrong.
It's wonderful to hear your passion come over and your enthusiasm come over for the role of advocating for patient safety. And Health Quality BC is actually a provincial and national leader in driving higher quality and safer healthcare, and that's been on your watch. And so you should be congratulated for that. But I'd love to ask you what, and I think we've got a little inkling of that from just you all speaking to us today. What keeps you motivated in that? We've heard about your origin story, and that if that isn't motivated enough. What keeps you motivated in this role, and what do you find rewarding in your role as CEO of Health Quality BC?
I mean, for me, at the end of the day, it comes down to I love people. I love working with people. I love learning from people. I love the opportunity to make things better for others is probably ultimately what drives me in this work. And I think, how lucky am I to be in the position that I'm in, to be able to focus on quality and safety, and to be able to support others to be able to work and lead in a different way. That's for us, that's always been at the core, is our hope that we support others to embrace and work in a different way. So we're not consultants who come in and try and solve will say, no, we'll stand beside you and we'll work on this together so that you don't need us next time. And I think it's a privilege to be able to be part of that. I think one of my favorite stories, maybe I'll share one last story, is when you actually see it in the system, like the impact of your work. So there's a campaign called What Matters to You, which is a fantastic campaign. It's been, I think part of my frustration is it's always been treated as a campaign. In June we have What Matters to You Day, and the reality is this is about the each clinical interaction that you have, should be asking the question, what matters to you right now? And so we're looking to kind of switch that up and try and embed it more into daily practice. But my mom ended up passing away from ovarian cancer 6 years ago now. And right when she was diagnosed, she was really struggling with some of the symptoms that you have. And so her very first visit, when she finally got into the cancer center and she was going to see the oncologist for the first time, and my mom was tiny. She was shorter than me by the time she passed away. She was just over 5 feet and very frail, very nervous, very scared. And we went to the Kelowna Cancer Center, and there was an LPN who greeted us, and he was probably 6'2" and a huge guy and towering over. And he weighed her and he did all the things, and then he put us into a room and he sat down and he said, "The oncologist will be with you shortly." And then he pulled his chair up and went knee to knee with my mom, and he said, "But before she does, I want to know what matters to you most right now." And I did a little fist bump in the corner because I was like, yes, okay, this is great. And what she said totally surprised me. I thought she was going to say, is my cancer treatable? Am I going to be eligible for surgery? And it wasn't. It was, I have relentless diarrhea and I'm scared to leave my home. And I want to be able to leave my home. He said, "Yeah, we will get that looked after before you leave today." And I thought, I wouldn't have known that that was what was her big challenge and most important to her. And I thought it was just such a small interaction from this gentle giant. And I did send an email after and thanking, but it was so impactful, and it changed what she shared for the rest of the whole visit. It set the whole tone. And I thought, we brought that, here. And so those moments, if it can change that little care experience, it's pretty cool. So that's why I love what I do.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful story. Thank you so much for sharing that and for sharing some of those personal details as well. It's not easy to relive those moments.
No,
So
no, it's not.
I thank you. And that's a great place to round up the interview today. Saying how lucky am I to be in this role? Well, how lucky are we to have you in this role, Christina?
Yeah,
It's
that's very generous. Thank
it's
you.
amazing. Thank you for this wonderful and enlightening conversation today. And as a token, and I know it's not much, we will be sending you one of our special coffee mugs for
Oh, good. No, I
Podcast
know
Mail.
about those, so I'm excited.
For coming on as a guest, everyone gets one, and they're very exclusive. So we'll be sending one of those your way. So thank you again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Christina Krause, the CEO of Health Quality BC. Join us next time for more great interviews on healthcare quality and check out our growing list of back episodes. Until then, it's goodbye from our guest, Christina Krause, and your hosts. I'm Sher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
If you enjoyed today's episode, check out our other episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts, and subscribe to our channel. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for us about healthcare quality improvement, email us at qualitycomms@northernhealth.ca, and your question could feature on a future episode. QualityCast North is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program of the Specialist Services Committee, a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation for the provincial health authorities. This episode was co-produced by Dr. Sher Chewy and Lee Cameron, with technical support from Levi Giles and Matt Walker of Expression North. Original music by Daniel Chewy. Further information about today's guest is available in our show notes on our website at nhpqi.ca.